Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, July 3rd, 1998. In the fireside room this morning, we have Fred Needner. Session number 98-5 and is titled, Lord, Remember Us in Your Kingdom and Lay Me Down to Sleep. Let's listen in.
Bringing comfort to my anxious soul, day by day, what blessings, Lord, you send me.
This day, and especially in this hour, as we ponder your word for us and your love of us. In Jesus' name, amen. In case the tape isn't rolling yet, roll the tape, please. Good morning. My name is Fred Needner, and this is the last of this week's series on Christian practices. As they are discussed in the Practicing Our Faith book, which sets our summer theme this summer. The practice for today is Dying Well. The title I gave up on the kiosk is Lord, Remember Us in Your Kingdom and Lay Me Down to Sleep. And the significance of that title won't come clear until near the end this morning. As for the hilarity quotient, dying is usually not considered a funny matter, but there is plenty of death humor. For example, the genre of arriving at the pearly gates is an absolutely enormous humor genre. But I chose not to bring any of that, partly because I didn't think of it before I left Valparaiso. So I will only share a couple of stories which I heard as true stories. I think one of them is true. I believe the other one is apocryphal. The true story involves W.C. Fields, and I'm sure at least some of you have also heard that story of how on his deathbed He was once visited by one of his cronies, his friends, and he was not a religious man, or at least was not known to be such. And someone once visited him in his hospital near the end of his life, and there he was sitting reading the Bible, and they said, "What in the world are you doing? Reading the Bible? You don't read the Bible." And he is alleged to have said, "Looking for loopholes." The other story involves another deathbed scene in which a person who'd never been a Christian had something of a deathbed conversion and was going to be baptized. And when the appropriate cleric was doing the baptismal rite, got to the point at which you ask the person being baptized, "Do you renounce the devil and all his works and ways?" And the person said, "No." And the pastor stopped and said, "Wait a minute, that's not how it's supposed to go. You're supposed to say yes." And the fellow is alleged to have said, "Yeah, I know that, but this does not seem to be a time I want to antagonize anyone." So, practice dying. The books chapter, as I read it, actually talks more about practices of a Christian community in response to the death of one within its number. But I suppose, you know, that is how we practice death. We can only practice it by being around it, since you actually only do get to do it once. And so just familiarity with the things surrounding death is probably as close as we get. And it's hard to actually practice dying. But that's what I do want to try to talk about this morning, is practicing dying. I do think that it is valuable to go through or to think about all these things that a Christian community does surrounding death as a way of practicing, because at least then you get to know ahead of time what the rest of the community is going to do when you do die. They're going to get together and do a lot of crying and have a ceremony and say some very official things about you, and then afterwards is the important part, when everybody gets together and has a party and tells a lot of stories about you and in the middle of laughing and crying. No matter how difficult the circumstances, usually that's what happens, is some gathering of the community to tell stories. And so that's what they'll do for every one of us. One of the favorite stories in my family is the story of my paternal grandfather, who died actually at 87 in his sleep one night after having written a pile of letters to different friends, giving no clue in any one of them that he was aware that he would die that night. And he simply slept away. His housekeeper found him in the morning. But just a few months before that, he had summoned the entire extended family to an unexplained event. He had paid for the transportation of everyone who he thought would use a little bit of could use a little assistance, and he threw this great big banquet at a banquet hall in the town where he lived, and then he got up after dinner and he made a big speech. He said, "I know that I don't have too much longer to live, and you're going to have a funeral, and you're all going to come to town and have a big party and tell a lot of stories, and I didn't want to miss it." So he said, "This is my pre-funeral party." And it sort of shocked everyone, but we decided it was a good idea. And we had a really good time, but we're not all that lucky. Not everyone gets to die so peacefully, nor does everyone get to die like maybe we all would like to, with our grandchildren gathered around our beds, singing us over to the other side at age 90 or so. Because there are so many other ways that people die, untimely deaths and tragic deaths. And so this is a much more complex thing to think about. I want to, just a couple other introductory comments. There's such vastly different advice out there about how to do these last things of one's life. As students, you know, you're held up, several models are held up for you. You know, there's the famous poem, go not gently into that long good night, rage, rage against the dying of the light. And then you get Socrates, who boldly takes the poison and makes a point of dying with purpose and with dignity, rather than raging against the dying of the light. Or there are other famous death scenes. I think, for example, having been told how Luther died, at least the version I heard was that in his weakness and illness, he is alleged to have said his last words were, "Wir sind Bettler, das ist wahr." We really are beggars, aren't we? So, you know, what do you do? Do you go down kicking and screaming, or do you go gently, purposefully, or what? So I thought we'd look at some biblical stories of dying today to give ourselves some models. And I've chosen stories of deaths of messiahs. We'll look at three stories and two messiahs. The first messiah whose death we will examine is a fellow, the Lord's anointed, called by God, Son of God, known as David. That would have been how the world of his day knew him, or at least his own people would have called him the Lord's Messiah, declared by Nathan the prophet in 2 Samuel 7, the Son of God. In the story of his death, we'll see an antitype, actually, of how to die. And I'd like to begin all the way back in 2 Samuel 11 and 12. This is the story of David and Bathsheba. It's sort of beside the point, but it's the story that begins with what I take to be one of the saddest lines in the whole Bible. In the spring of the year, the time when kings go out to make war, as though along with the rising of the plants from the frozen ground comes also the testosterone boiling up that sends kings off to war, whether they need to or not. You know, it's springtime, let's go out and whop up some Ammonites. You know. But anyway, pardon?
2 Samuel what?
2 Samuel 11. Anyway, David remains behind and from his rooftop takes to lusting after the neighbor lady whose husband happens to be an officer who's off fighting one of those battles. And the unseemly affair ensues, which results ultimately not only in a pregnancy, but the murder of Uriah, the husband, so that Bathsheba becomes the wife of David. And then in chapter 12, verse 15, the Lord struck the child that Uriah bore to David, and it became very ill. And David pleads with God for the child, but to no avail, and the child dies. And David has mourned for a goodly stretch even before the child dies, so that when the child dies, he now cleans himself up. And when the surprised group finds him no longer mourning, he says at chapter 12, verse 22, "While the child was alive, I fasted and wept, for I said, 'Who knows? The Lord may be gracious to me, and the child may live, but now he is dead. Why should I fast? Can I bring him back again?'" And here's the line then, I shall go to him, but he will not return to me. So there's a foreshadowing of David's death. He will go the way of this child, struck down by the Lord for David's sins. And as Christians, of course, for us, it's a big irony that this is but the first of David's sons who will die for his sins. After this comes a whole lot of other narrative about the tangled affairs of David's household. David does not remember the nature and the depth of his own lust, and so when his sons begin to do the same thing, he chooses not to see it, and his household sinks deeper and deeper into the aftermath of such things as he has done. And he begins to lose more sons to murder and other such things that make up the aftermath of his failings and his inattention. And we get next, the next thing I'd like us to look at is a moment in the Absalom mess. 2 Samuel 18 tells the story of Absalom's demise. And when David finally receives the news that Absalom has been slain, and you remember who slew Absalom, Joab, the fellow who slays all of David's enemies, actually. David never is around to kill his own enemies, but Joab usually does them in, and then David mourns their loss. So David is always protected from having to do the bloody work himself. This time it's a son who dies, and the king was deeply moved, verse 33, and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And as he went, he said, "Oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would I had died instead of you. Oh, Absalom, my son, my son." Now, you can't dispute the reality of the grief, but it's sort of an irony that he would now wish to die instead of his son. His sons keep dying for him and over his mistakes, and how he wishes he could turn that around, but he is unable. And we do finally get to his own death in chapter 1 Kings, excuse me, chapters 1 and 2. Begins with the announcement that David was old and advanced in years, could not even keep himself warm anymore. He's failing seriously. They try multiple ways to keep him warm, including bringing a young woman from the palace to lie with him, but not even that will work. He does not have a restful end, because instead of the grandchildren all coming around and singing the songs of Israel, we have palace intrigue going on perpetually. Adonijah has made himself king as David lies unable to reign. And Bathsheba now shows up to plead for old David to remember the promise that her son would be king. And so we get all this whispering going on around the deathbed. My son should be king. You've got to fix this. And so from his bed, David makes utterances that ultimately result in Solomon becoming king. But this, of course, turns out to be a death sentence for Adonijah. And then the death scene itself in chapter 2. When David's time to die drew near, he charged his son Solomon, saying, "I'm about to go the way of all the earth. Be strong, courageous, and keep the charge of the Lord your God, walking in all the commandments," and so forth. But then verse 5, you also know what Joab, son of Zeruiah, did to me, how he dealt with the two commanders of the armies of Israel, Abner, son of Ner, and Amasa, son of Jether, whom he murdered, retaliating in time of peace for blood that had been shed in war, and putting the blood of war on the belt round his waist and on the sandals of his feet. So Joab, his faithful servant, who killed all his enemies for him, so David was always safe. He tells Solomon, act therefore according to your wisdom. Do not let his gray head go down to Sheol in peace. And so Solomon will go off to kill Joab. Deal loyally, however, with the sons of Barzillai, the Gileadite, and let them be among those who eat at your table. For with loyalty they met me when I fled from your brother Absalom. There's also with you Shimei, son of Gera, the Benjaminite from Bahurim, who cursed me with a terrible curse on the day that I went to Machanaim. Shimei cursed him for having done some terrible things. And David knew that he deserved the rebuke, and so he accepted it, even though this was a man who had cursed the Lord's Messiah. And you simply don't curse the Lord's Messiah in Israel. That's who David was. But David knew that what Shimei had said was true, and so he did not have him killed. But now, when he came down to meet me at the Jordan, I swore to him, by the Lord, I will not put you to death with the sword. But now, Solomon, therefore, you do not hold him guiltless, for you are a wise man. You will know what you ought to do to him, and you must bring his gray head down with blood to Sheol. And then David slept with his ancestors. And so with his dying breaths, David asks for vengeance on two of his contemporaries, one of whom was his faithful servant who had killed all his enemies, and the other one someone who had cursed him rightly.
Wasn't that a way of silencing to protect his reputation after he was dead, that this wouldn't become known?
That may have been what his intention was, but unfortunately in Israel you don't get away with that because narrators like this tell your story. I think that's what he's doing. He's going down covering his tracks. He's dying, taking others down with him, with his dying breaths, attempting to erase his sins. So I would offer that as an antitype of how you want to die. A long time later, of course, comes a son of David, Jesus of Nazareth, whom we call the Lord's Messiah and Son of God. And there are four stories of his dying in the canon. The one I'd like to look at with you this morning most closely is the story in the Gospel of Mark. The first text we'll look at is in Mark 13, 9 and following. The Gospel of Mark is read in several ways. The way I read it, and we'll spin it out for you this morning, is the reading, which I suppose is in some way the most common reading still today, that Mark was written for a persecuted audience, some way or another related to the Neronic persecutions of 64 to 70 AD, when for the first time Christians were persecuted as Christians. sporadically and pretty much locally in and around Rome. This is not yet the empire-wide systematic persecutions of Domitian and after over the business of emperor worship. But Nero had blamed the fire of Rome on Christians, and some brutal and nasty persecutions began for a few years. And many believe that Mark wrote for people caught up in that. Whoever he wrote for was facing danger for the sake of their faith. In the first half of Mark's gospel, Jesus lives secretly. He does not allow anybody to get very close at all to this identity given to him at his baptism as Son of God. He speaks in code. He explains to the questioners who want to know why he speaks in parables that it's to keep things a secret, so that you who know the secret can understand, but those outside can't know. That's in chapter 4. In the second half of the gospel, however, Jesus begins a journey to Jerusalem and is very open now about what's going to happen, and he's no longer secret. And in 8:30 and in 9:30 and in 10:30, Mark develops a rhythm of Jesus announcing, "I'm going up to Jerusalem to die. I'm going up to Jerusalem to die. I'm going up to Jerusalem to die." You get it? And he says, "If you would like to come along, you must be ready to take up your cross and follow. Because this is a journey on which if you try to save your life, you'll lose it. And if you lose your life for my sake, you'll save it." So this is a cross-bearing journey. And for Mark's audience, this is not a figure of speech. If you are Mark's audience, very likely if you take up a cross in a half hour, you will be on it, and that will be that. And Jesus warns the disciples in Mark's gospel that this is about their death, not merely his own. And that's what you see in chapter 13. Mark 13, verses 9 and following, which I didn't turn to because I was talking. "As for yourselves, beware, for they will hand you over to councils, and you will be beaten in synagogues, and you'll stand before governors and kings because of me, as a testimony to them." And the reader, of course, who's read this story many times, knows this is what's going to happen to Jesus. It's also going to happen to the disciples and to you, the readers. "When they bring you to trial and hand you over, don't worry beforehand about what you're to say, but say whatever is given you at that time, for it's not you who speak, but the Holy Spirit. Brother will betray brother to death, and a father his child, and children will rise against parents and have them put to death, and he'll be hated by everybody because of me. But the one who endures to the end will be saved." So these are the directions. When it happens to you, A, don't make speeches. If there's words to be said, the Holy Spirit will give them to you. And B, endure to the end. That's where you're saved. And then comes Mark's passion narrative, the story of Jesus going the way of the cross. And the way I read Mark's passion narrative, every part of it is written for persecuted people and communities of persecuted people who need to deal with the possibility of their own martyrdoms, but also with the internal community problems that persecuted groups must face, like the pressure of knowing that at any given time there are probably traitors among us. And what would it mean if you tried to identify them? You know, and that's about the worst thing you could do, is to tear the community apart with suspicion. You know, let's not meet tonight where we usually do, because I think George is slipping. I think he's a traitor. so let's cut him out of the circle. Well, maybe he is a traitor, but maybe he isn't. And of course, they all knew that it could be any of them. Funny things happened in persecuted communities. You never knew when something was going to happen that would bring you to the point of being a traitor. So that's just an example of what you had to live with day after day after day in a persecuted community. So in Mark's gospel, when you have the Last Supper, and Jesus announces at the Last Supper that there's a traitor here, verses 17 and following, 14, 17. They began to be distressed, verse 19, and to say one after another, "Surely not I." He said, "It's one of the 12, somebody dipping bread with me. Son of Man goes as it's written, but woe to that one." And while they're eating, he took a loaf of bread and blessed it and broke it and gave it to them and said, "This is my body." And in Mark's gospel, we don't identify who the traitor is, nor do we dismiss the traitor as in John. We just don't do that in a persecuted community because we don't know who it is. And it could be any of us. It could be the faithful people who crack. And so you continue with the Lord's Supper, even knowing there are traitors among us. We end up out on the garden, in the Garden of Gethsemane, and we know it's going to be tough. If it was tough for Jesus, it's going to be tough for anybody. Three times he throws himself to the earth and prays that if possible, that there could be a way out of this. It's not like Jesus said, "All right, let's go do it." This was terribly difficult. He was sorrowful, sick to death over this. That's what it's going to be like, folks. Practice that. He gives them the words for the practice, the Abba prayer. "Abba, Father, thy will be done." You know that prayer? That's the prayer you pray when it's your turn. When you are sick and scared to death, just pray that prayer. That's what it's for. Then comes the arrest scene, and in case we had forgotten that this is really about us, Mark has a way to make sure we are in this story, because there's this weird guy who doesn't really belong there, out there on the Mount of Olives on Passover night. And the Mount of Olives was then and still is the cemetery of Jerusalem. So because there weren't enough places to spend the night in the city on the night of Passover, the city council changed the zoning laws so that the Mount of Olives was considered inside the city and you could go out there and spend the night in the cemetery, which is what they were doing. And as they come to arrest Jesus out there in the cemetery, a certain young man, verse 51, was following him wearing nothing but a linen cloth, and they caught hold of him, but he left the linen cloth and he ran off naked. Who was that masked man? Well, in the 19th century, somebody first raised the possibility that maybe this was Mark. That's relatively speaking, a very recent suggestion, but there's no textual evidence for that. Could be. But there's another way, regardless of what individual this might have been, there's another role that this character plays. His clothes are the clue. He's dressed in a linen cloth. And the word syndon in the Greek, which is used there, refers to a strip of cloth 18 inches to a couple feet wide and anywhere from 15 to 30 feet long. It was used for wrapping corpses. It was a burial garment, a burial cloth that this guy was wearing. So what in the world is a guy doing out there on Passover night in the cemetery cruising the Mount of Olives wearing one of those? It sounds almost kinky. You know, and they grab hold of him, and I do not know how you get out of one of those quickly. You know, they get a hold of one end and you spin off into the night. But anyway, so here's a guy who leaves his burial cloth behind and flees naked. But he will show up again in the story. He is referred to here as a neoniskos, a young man, means a new person, a new guy. And that's the same person who shows up in chapter 16 at the empty tomb when the women come to take care of the body. All they find is a new guy, now dressed in a white garment, who says he is risen. Now, Mark's early readers are going to recognize that character by function and role, even if they don't know his name, because he's really them. Those first readers of Mark will recognize, yeah, they did that. There was a night before the Easter celebration when they were stripped of their regular clothes, dressed in a burial garment, taken to the baptismal waters, and then stripped of the burial garment, baptized into Christ, and dressed in a new white robe. And on the morning that we call Easter, it was the new guys who testified to their faith in the resurrection and said, he is risen. So whoever this fellow is, he is one of those who, like us readers, have been buried with Christ by baptism into his death, and now testify to faith in the resurrection. So here's a way to practice dying. Baptism is our way of entering this story of the one who's dying on his way to the cross. In the trials, in the Gospel of Mark, Jesus does not make up any speeches. He is quiet. He is following his own advice. He told everyone else, don't make speeches. When you get hauled before officials, don't make up any speeches. The Holy Spirit will give you words, and the Holy Spirit doesn't give him much to say. So he stands there silent. Pretty much of the time, he answers one question. Are you the Christ? Yes, I am. So in the moment of greatest danger, he makes his confession. There were people who weren't able to make that confession. When the Romans lined people up and asked them one by one, are you a Christian? And they said yes, they usually just killed them right on the spot. Eusebius, who wrote this all up in the 4th century, says one of their favorite ways was just line a whole bunch of people up against the wall and ask them, are you a Christian? If they said yes, they took sharp poles and just stuck them right to the wall. And imagine yourself about 6 people down the line. Are you a Christian? Yes. Well, here you are. You've heard this a few times. Those guys are groaning down there along the line. They get to you and you hear yourself in your hysteria say, no, I'm not one of them. Not me. Must be some mistake. Well, prove it, they would say. Curse Jesus. That's all you had to do. 3 times. Anathema Jesus. Jesus be damned. They'd let you go. They didn't care. They knew these groaning guys heard you. And so did these others. So they'd let you go. This is what persecuted communities faced. People were always coming back from those scenes saying, can I come back? I didn't mean it. I even gave them some of your names. I don't know what we're going to do about that. So do you forgive them or not forgive them? This is a dilemma for persecuted communities, and Mark's message surely seems to be, well, Peter was one of them. The next guy in line in Mark's gospel denied, and that was Peter. He was one of them, and look what God was able to do with him, if God could do that with Peter. First of all, anybody out there who thinks they wouldn't crack, Peter was Mr. I won't crack under pressure. Everybody else might, but I won't. So it could happen to anybody, and if God could make the chief apostle of the church out of one of them, maybe you ought to forgive him also. Jesus then goes to his death. Utterly abandoned in Mark's gospel, there are no friendly crowds as in Luke. Nobody hangs around close by as in John. But he's utterly alone in this. Everyone mocks him. Passers-by, soldiers, fellow crucified taunt him as well. And he dies with but one word. Our Traore services would be very different if all we had was Mark. We would not have seven last words from the cross. We would have only, my God, why have you forsaken me? It's the only line. It's the perfect dramatic way for Mark's gospel to do this. Because this is what it will look like, people. It will look like you're going to die alone, abandoned by everybody. Friends, the vaunted Roman legal system, your own people. It's going to look even like you die abandoned by God. Get ready for that. That's how it's going to feel. Practice that. Except that we all know Mark 22 is also the first line, Mark's cry here is the first line of Psalm 22, which is a psalm of lament, which is a psalm just for times when you're facing death. And probably Mark means to say not merely that Jesus cried out the first line, but that Jesus died praying, or I like to think Jesus died singing, Psalm 22, a psalm he'd practiced his whole life, which is a way of practicing dying. And Psalm 22 says, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from helping me? Don't you see what's happening to me? Look what they're doing to me. This is terrible for half the psalm. But the rest of the psalm is, but I know you're going to do something about this. Partly because if you don't, people will talk. That's always a part of Psalms of Lament, you know. You get a little bit under God's skin. But I trust you, God, and I'm just going to wait. I'm not going anywhere. I'm just going to wait. And you will redeem me. And I will praise you. And the centurion was not used to this. The centurion had killed a lot of guys. The centurion probably even knew about guys who had the power to take others down with them and get vengeance on their enemies and cover their tracks. But he'd surely seen a lot of guys die cursing everybody around. I mean, what do you got to lose? You might as well curse the centurion. Centurion, you and your mother. You know, that's how guys died on crosses. But not this guy. This guy dies praying to his God, and in the hopelessness of this fiasco, he says, I'll wait for you, God. And so the centurion in Mark's gospel is the first human being to confess who Jesus is. Not even one of the disciples ever said, you are the Son of God. And the centurion does. This is Mark's way of telling persecuted audiences what it looks like to end, and what the power of a well-died death has. If you can die this faithfully, tragic as your death will be, it will have its effect. It will bring your persecutors to confess the same thing that's getting you killed. So there is enormous power in a death well died. And of course, there's a whole lot of other theology here. Jesus has described his death as a ransom for many, and so unlike that first Messiah and Son of God, David, who took others down with him in his attempt to cover his sins, Jesus' death is a ransom for many. Sort of the antidote to David's way of dying. So that's a picture of a death. And this is a death that you practice. There is some substantial theory and persuasive argument to suggest that Mark's gospel was used as a drama in Christian communities, perhaps for the Easter time, so that they could practice this story and literally practice dying, so that when it was their time to face this, they could die faithfully in the hope of the resurrection. The session title, Now I Lay Me Down to Sleep, comes actually from Luke's picture of Jesus' death, which I will summarize very quickly since I talked so long on Mark. I didn't leave much time, and I do want to have at least a few minutes of discussion. Luke's gospel is offers a very different picture because Luke was not writing for the same kind of audience. Luke was writing for people that weren't facing imminent destruction for their faith. All the early Christian communities lived in sort of precarious circumstances, but Luke's audience is people of some substance and even perhaps some people of some power. And so when Luke portrays Jesus calling people to the life of cross-bearing, the words get changed slightly, and it's no longer, if anyone would come after me, let that one take up a cross and follow me, but it becomes, let that one take up a cross daily and follow me, because for Luke's audience, it is a figure of speech, not a literal cross on which you'll be on in a half an hour. So it's daily cross-bearing that Luke calls his audience of people like ourselves to. And so in Luke's gospel, there are all sorts of alterations to the passion narrative. In Luke's gospel, just a few of the details, we get a look at what a day of daily cross-bearing looks like when Simon of Cyrene is picked from the crowd and called to carry the cross behind Jesus, Luke says, where he will now walk in Jesus' footsteps and get a demonstration of what a day of cross-bearing looks like. So Simon of Cyrene is going to go to daily cross-bearing school. And what does Jesus do? And a bunch of things happen that only happen in Luke. Jesus speaks to the mourners who are so upset about this. Daughters of Jerusalem, don't weep for me. Let's weep for you and for your children. This is what we have to focus on. He gets to the scene of execution, and only in Luke he says, Father, forgive them. They don't even know what they're doing. Only in Luke do we have this scene we rehearsed here the other morning, where one of the crucified is a friendly companion in death, and they set up their plans for a kingdom while they're hanging there on the cross. So in Luke's gospel, along your way of daily cross-bearing, you don't focus on your own plight, it's others to whom you remain in service to the very end. Your life remains one all day, every day, even on the last day, as a life of compassion and intercession and companionship with those along your way. And then in Luke's gospel, there is no cry of dereliction. My God, why have you forsaken me? There's a different psalm altogether. And Jesus goes out singing also in Luke. Only he sings from Psalm 31, verse 5. Psalm 31 was and still is an evening song in Israel. And that part of the song, I read a long time ago, was used as a bedtime prayer that Jewish moms taught their babies the way we teach, "Now I lay me down to sleep. I pray thee, Lord, my soul." Pardon me? Psalm 31, verse 5, which is, "Into your hands I give my spirit, O God, thou faithful God." And so, it's possible this is the first prayer Jesus ever learned from his parents as a little boy. And in Luke's gospel, he dies praying his bedtime prayer. "Now I lay me down to sleep. I pray thee, Lord, my soul to keep. If I should die before I wake, I pray thee, Lord, my soul to take." And that's how you can live that way, is if you know every day of your life, that's where you end up. Whether you live or whether you die, you end up in those hands. And so every day is a practice for dying and handing yourself over into those hands where life began. So there are two pictures of that Messiah dying. One of them, I mean, in each he dies obviously tragically and young, cut down in the prime of life. But one of them is tailored for dying in the flames of persecution. The other one is tailored for folks who are probably going to die in their beds at the end of a day of daily cross-bearing. So these are two pictures for practicing how to die. Got 5 minutes.
Is there a significant difference, as you read, between the centurion's last word in Luke as opposed to Mark?
Yeah, in Luke the centurion says, "Surely this man was innocent," because the question in Luke's gospel is not the Son of God question. That's a very central piece of Mark's agenda. In Luke's question, in Luke's passion narrative, the question is this man a rabble-rousing tax rebel who is bent on destroying the empire, which was the charge against the Christian community, a charge against the Christian community. And Luke uses his passion narrative to disabuse Theophilus of this rumor that the Christians are up to that. And so that Jesus is pronounced innocent of this charge of tax rebellion. So there's a political agenda going on in Luke that is absent from Mark. Well, you think you can use Mark today? I mean, few of you are going to die on crosses, I would bet. Literal crosses. But you find that persecution picture useful, or can you imagine? Or maybe we could ask this question if you don't want to talk about Mark and Luke. What does a well-died death look like today?
I was present when both my father and my mother died, not at the instant of their last breath, but the things that my father and I went through as a father and a son, I think a lot of it will shape the adult male that I am henceforth. My father and I reached a point of our relationship where we had a beautiful closure. I mean, all the things, all the conflicts that we'd gone through as our lives unfolded as a relationship came to a complete closure. There was no place else for us to go. And one of my father's dying gestures was He was so weak on his bed, but he was able to lift his arm up and put his hand behind my head and scratch it. And it was one of those little gestures that he used to do to me as a real small child. And it sort of transcended all those years, and it was, to me, one of those things where he says, I love you today as much as I loved you as a little 3 or 4 or 5 year old boy. And the last thing I was able to say to my father was, thank you for being more father to my sisters than I had a right to ask for, and more a husband to my mother than I could expect. I love you, Dad. I kissed him and walked out of his room. And, you know, it means there's a lot of things I'll be as a father to my children as a result of that experience that I had with my father in his last several days and weeks.
Yeah.
It's wonderful when that happens. I worry a little about the times it doesn't happen, perhaps because of dementia,
yeah.
You know, or other the physical ordeal that a person might be in. And I don't want to make dying well something that is an accomplishment,
yeah.
Of a person under such pressure. In fact, I remember one funeral for a very faithful person, lifelong, who I think didn't die well in that sense of personal accomplishment because of the physical ordeal of it all, and a sense that the funeral service was restoring her to her faith, her place of faithfulness,
right.
That, you know, she really served on the basis of her lifelong faith rather than self-accomplishment
there
in the final days.
Yeah. Theologically, you know, I guess I left a couple things without tying them up. For all of what I said about David, we do finally confess that this other Messiah took care of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that when it so happens that we should die like David, well, that's been handled. Yeah, and we don't remember David because of that.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the reason we don't remember David for that is because of his son. Yeah, and there's forgiveness, and we don't. It's sad when those things happen, because sometimes people bear burdens that they then have to find some other way to handle when people die leaving vengeance behind and other ugliness, but there's forgiveness for that too.
I think a lot of it doesn't really depend, matter too much how the person dies, it can be well or more, but I do a lot of funerals for people I don't know in our community, so I have to meet with the family, and I can tell within 5 minutes of meeting with this family what this person was like, in the sense that sometimes there's just tons of love, and that's been the base of this person's life, and it's, you know, just a matter of writing things down and repeating it to people at the service, and other times, there's nothing there. You know, this person has spent a life, and there's no life to celebrate, hardly. It's sad.
I'm sure in Chris and Maury's session we'll be sharing a lot of stories about that, but I just wanted to comment on your question about Mark's gospel. Obviously, we don't experience the kind of absolutely concrete and brutal persecution that's there, but I think there is definitely a use for that. And in our confirmation camps that we do, 7th and 8th, by far the most memorable in terms of both its fun but also its meaning night of the whole week is Romans and Christians. It's a game played the last night of camp into the dark of night, you know, and they're role playing, and usually the big burly football player counselors are the Romans, you know. And so it's a kind of a glorified hide and seek game. But the kids really take it seriously. And a lot of kids who have never played the game have that moment of, you know, being scared bejeebers in the darkness of night, you know, by a guy jumping out. And then part of the goal, you have certain marks on your hand or whatever, you know, you're in jail or dead. But part of the goal is to try to convert the Roman soldier to faith. And out of a week long of fun and spiritual exercises, by far is the most memorable night of confirmation camp. And, you know, and there's some debriefing and talking about the setting of the early church in Mark's Gospel. Mm-hmm. So I think there's definitely still use for that. And slap us in the face, you know, how easy we have it.
It's a very literal way to practice. Well, thank you very much.